Arizona's economy is on the mend, and the state is bringing in more revenue. But lawmakers don't seem to have a lot of wiggle room on the budget. How programs and services may fare during the upcoming spending plan.
If there's any lessons that have come out of the Great Recession, it's that states learn to use any and every tool available in order to bring their budgets into balance.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, state budgets, still a work in progress. Prisons are turning more and more to video chats to let inmates communicate with their loved ones, but will that reduce in-person visits?
And what happens to our digital lives when we leave this one?
You can take 5 or 10 minutes and write down your most important accounts with their usernames and passwords, and you will have done more than 90% of the population. You will save your family so much time.
Plus, tech in 2014, gambling in Japan, and fossils in a new part of a national park.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Thousands of flights have been canceled around the country thanks to a massive winter storm that slammed the Northeast overnight. At least 11 deaths are blamed on that storm that hit the eastern half of the country. Now gusting winds and sub-zero temperatures are the worry. Several schools and offices and roads were closed around the Northeast. North of Boston got nearly 2 feet of snow. New York City got just under 10 inches. But NPR's Margo Adler reports the cold is more of a problem.
Mayor Bill de Blasio said a 4 a.m. decision to close the school system, which serves a million pupils, was made primarily due to the cold. The city had a low of 8 degrees this morning, and it will not get out of the teens. De Blasio said given the expected delays of school buses and mass transit,
we didn't want our children exposed to a situation that would be very windy, icy, and very, very cold.
The new mayor asked residents to plow around fire hydrants, not to plow snow in the streets, and to help seniors in need. He said plows had reached 100% of the city's primary roads, 92% of secondary roads, and 93% of tertiary roads. Around 750 flights in and out of the three main airports, JFK, LaGuardia, and Newark, were canceled due to the storm, but the three airports are all now open. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
About 20 American personnel from the U.S. Embassy in Juba, South Sudan, have been evacuated on a military transport.
Due to the deteriorating security situation and out of an abundance of caution, the Department of State ordered the departure of most remaining U.S. government personnel from South Sudan.
Marie Harf is a State Department spokeswoman.
We've evacuated over 440 U.S. officials and private citizens and more than 750 citizens of at least 27 other countries.
Fighting between those loyal to the government and rebels has left hundreds dead and forced thousands from their homes. Harf says more evacuations may take place. Consular services for U.S. citizens have moved from South Sudan to Kenya. Secretary of State John Kerry kicked off his latest peacemaking trip to the Mideast with a clear message to Israeli and Palestinian leaders. The time to make tough decisions is now. Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem.
At the start of his visit yesterday, John Kerry said, "The time is soon arriving where leaders are going to have to make difficult decisions. We are close to that time, if not at it." His goal now is to get Israeli and Palestinian leaders to agree to a framework on what a final peace deal will look like, so the two sides will know where peace negotiations are heading. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu greeted Kerry yesterday with words of skepticism. He said, "There's growing doubt in Israel that the Palestinians are committed to peace," and accused the Palestinian government of continued incitement against Israel. Kerry meets the Palestinian president later today. From NPR News, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Preliminary closing numbers on Wall Street. The Dow was up 28 points to end the day at 16,470. The Nasdaq down 11, ending the day at 4,132. The S&P 500 down just a fraction at 1831. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Quick check of traffic. It's been pretty light the last few days as people are taking a little extra long holiday break, it seems, Mark. An accident 101 northbound in the West Valley at 91st Avenue. Also a collision moved to the side of the road on the 60 eastbound at Signal Butte. Our valley forecast for today, we're calling for clear skies for the rest of the afternoon. For tonight, clear skies and lows in the mid-40s. For tomorrow, should be partly cloudy with a high around 70. It's currently 72 degrees in Phoenix.
In the news this hour, a rail car that's been leaking ethanol near downtown Phoenix since early this morning has been moved. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, the rail car has been leaking the highly flammable liquid at a rate of about 100 gallons an hour.
The plan is to pump the remaining ethanol out of the rail car and into tankers at the Union Pacific rail yard. Ruben Saavedra is a spokesman for the Phoenix Fire Department. He says the operation is happening slowly and carefully, especially since employees at local businesses are working nearby. Saavedra says an explosion or fire is not likely.
But we are working with PD, so in the event that this situation did change, we are in communication with PD. They are part of our unified command team there, and they are there to, in the event that something did go wrong, they have staff and personnel to, if we needed to do an evacuation.
Saavedra says more than 100 fire and safety personnel are on the scene, and they do have foam on hand in case a fire breaks out. He adds that there is no known cause of the leak yet, but loose bolts around a valve on the rail car could be the culprit. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Former Congressman Rick Renzi will have another week before he has to report to prison to begin serving his sentence for convictions on public corruption, money laundering, and other charges. He was supposed to report on Monday, but his lawyers had asked to postpone that until the 13th to give a federal judge a chance to rule on Renzi's pending request to remain free on bail while he appeals his convictions. Renzi was accused of using his office for personal financial gain and looting a family insurance business to help pay for his 2002 campaign.
The next mayor and city council in Mesa will make a lot more money. As KJZZ's Dennis Lambert explains, the current city council approved the pay hikes last month.
The raises, which will be effective for members elected later this year, will increase the Mesa mayor's pay from the current $33,600 to $73,545. And city council members will see their pay go from $16,800 to $36,832. The East Valley Tribune says vehicle allowances for the mayor and council are also being increased. Those hikes take place in mid-January of this year. All of the raises are based on the report of an independent group commissioned by the council in 2012 and composed of five Mesa residents. They compared the salaries of Mesa officials with those of other similar cities. Panel members found the mayor's salary was fifth highest in the state, even though Mesa is the state's third largest city, with a population of $450,000. By comparison, the City of Phoenix website says the mayor of the state's largest city makes $88,000 a year, while council members make $61,000. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
Flipping the calendar to 2014 also means the work of some of Arizona's elected officials is getting restarted. As of this week, the Phoenix City Council now has two new members, Laura Pastor of District 4 and Kate Gallego of District 8. So will fresh faces also equal fresh ideas for moving the city in a particular direction? Gallego says the city still has some financial limitations.
We are losing some revenue related to the council's decision, which I believe was correct, to phase out the food tax early. So that does take away some resources. And we rely heavily on property tax, which will recover in a few years because we see already housing values are going up. But that will take a few years to show up in our tax collection. So I think we do need to be very fiscally responsible and aware that we have limited resources.
Do you plan to be influential as a new voice and someone who's not going to be shy about expressing her ideas?
Yes. So far, it seems like people are very responsive, my fellow council members, to the ideas we've been talking about and some of the issues I brought up during the campaign. I represent District 8, which includes the airport area, part of East Phoenix, and a lot of the industrial land for the city where we could have good high-wage jobs. And yesterday at the council inauguration, there was strong interest from everyone on the council about working on economic development and high-wage jobs. And our district is really well positioned to be able to do that because we do have vacant land in near the central area of the city. So there's a sense there's a lot of opportunity and that we have the right council in place to take advantage of those opportunities.
Are you getting the feeling that council members want to move the city in a particular direction, even if they want to always vote together, or do you see some bumps along the way?
On economic development, we seem to share a common vision. The city's been developing an economic development plan that emphasizes international business ties, and everyone on the council seems to agree that we're well positioned to move forward, but that these companies won't come to us, that we have to aggressively pursue them. So I think we have strong support for having a trade office in Mexico, which we've recently opened, and really making sure that people know that Phoenix is open for business and that we have the resources companies need. There will be some issues, particularly social issues, where I think we will have a divided council. But on the core issues, like making sure we get more police on the street, we do share the same vision.
Your husband, Ruben, is a state lawmaker. Are you getting the impression that the state legislature, when it opens up later this month, is going to be more receptive to what cities and municipalities want to do?
We have more and more legislators who have city experience, and I think that's very helpful. They understand the issues that we're facing. They understand cities have to succeed to have a successful Arizona, and that we need to deliver on water, sewer, police, public safety, and that we are the branch of government that are getting things done. So I am optimistic we will have a better relationship with the legislature and they'll understand the city perspective.
Kate Gallego is the new council member of Phoenix's District 8. Ken Strobeck is executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. He says he doesn't anticipate an improving economy or other factors leading to new aggressive legislative pushes in the session that begins in a couple of weeks.
The vast majority of our lobbying involves education, telling legislators the impact of certain bills on cities and towns, and really explaining how local government works in this state, what services we provide, and how we work, you know, cooperatively and not competitively with the state government. Our lobbying, I don't think, is going to change because of the improvement in the economy. We'll still do the same things. And our biggest push is to try to preserve our own local ability to raise our own revenue. We've had bills the last few sessions on impact fees, on changes to the sales tax. All those things hit us in the pocketbook.
Right.
And so that's what the majority of our work is education and trying to make it so that cities and towns can continue to do the good work that they're doing locally.
What bills are you looking at that could directly impact cities and towns?
This year, I don't expect that we're going to see big legislation on impact fees or TPT. We had those last year. We're in the implementation process. We don't need to be changing, you know, horses in the middle of the stream and rewriting the rules. We're working with the Department of Revenue and all these other agencies to make sure that they go into effect. I think the one thing that that might be different in what you're talking about for a little loosening of the purse strings would be on the matter of HERF, Highway User Revenue Funds. And that's something that the legislature for the last 10 years has dipped into, basically amended the statutory distribution formula and said, we're going to take around $130 million a year out of that fund and transfer it over to the Department of Public Safety. And that's money that directly goes to not only ADOT, but also to counties, cities, and towns for construction and maintenance, preservation and maintenance of streets and highways and roads.
Earlier, I spoke with New Phoenix Councilwoman Kate Gallego. She says there are more lawmakers who understand what cities are trying to accomplish now. Is she right?
Well, I think we do have some people who are in the legislature that have had very recent city experience. You know, Karen Fan from District 1, Doug Holman, a small group. But, you know, over time, even people that haven't had any direct city experience have come to know what cities and towns are doing. President Biggs, Speaker Tobin, they didn't have any direct municipal experience. But they're people that we can definitely communicate with, talk to, and who understand where we're coming from. In many cases, it's just one or two people who set the tone for whether it's either a positive relationship or a negative relationship. And I'll be optimistic and say I hope that this year there will be more on the positive side than the negative side.
Ken Strobeck, Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns.
It's the show on KJZZ. Governor Jan Brewer is expected to release her budget proposal for the upcoming fiscal year 2 weeks from today. And while the state's economy is getting better, most observers don't expect the new spending plan to include a lot of new spending. And that seems to be true across the country. Todd Haggerty is a policy analyst with the National Conference of State Legislatures and wrote the group's most recent budget update. He describes state budgets nationwide as stable but not spectacular.
What we're seeing is that, you know, 4.5 years after the end of the Great Recession, state budget recovery still remains a work in progress. You know, there are some positives. On one hand, you're seeing an absence of budget gaps, and revenues are growing. So that's good news. But on the other side, we're kind of looking at this, the revenue growth that we're seeing is not as robust as we've seen coming out of previous recoveries. So it puts, you know, states in this, you know, stable but, you know, in a position where, you know, there's not really a lot of wiggle room.
So does that mean that states in general are looking to sort of maintain funding levels that they've had but not really initiate too many new programs?
Yeah, that's really what we're seeing. And if anything, you can look at kind of how, if you're looking at the four major areas of spending across the states, K-12 education, higher education, corrections, and Medicaid. For those first three, you know, save Medicaid, you're seeing growth, you know, hovering around that the 2.4% to just under 5%. The only one exception, as I mentioned there, was Medicaid, where you are seeing growth of 5% or in excess, and a lot of that has to do with the Affordable Care Act.
Now, it looks like Arizona kind of falls into that as well, where, you know, it's doing okay, the current budget and the next 2015 budget, which will start on July 1 of 2014, stable, expected to be balanced, but maybe not in a fantastic position.
Right. Arizona does have there's some commonalities with some other states. For this year and, you know, for the next year, things are looking relatively stable. And a lot of that has to do with some large ending balances from the previous fiscal year that states are being able to use those funds moving ahead for the next couple of years. But after that, you're starting to see, you know, the potential for some structural budget issues.
Now, structural deficit was a phrase that here in Arizona we heard a lot of, especially during the recession. So could that potentially mean more cuts?
You know, if there's any lessons that have come out of the Great Recession is that states learn to use any and every tool available in order to bring their budgets into balance. So when you're looking forward, I think states have a lot of experience here. That's why you have a number that have made concerted efforts to put additional funds into their rainy day fund balances and to have some discussions around limiting the use of one-time funds moving forward. And also looking, where can efficiencies and savings be found? You know, there's never a magic wand that can, you know, eliminate these structural issues going forward without having to, you know, go back to budget reductions, which may have to happen in some cases.
Now, in Arizona, two of the three big revenue generators, personal income tax and sales tax, both were up in your report. Corporate income tax was down by 18.5%, which seems like a lot. Do you look at those numbers and are they a harbinger for anything down the road, good or bad, do you think?
So it's always good, especially in Arizona's case, because, you know, while we say those are the big three taxes, individual income, corporate income, and sales tax, a bulk of the money across the states and with Arizona as well comes from those individual income and sales. And corporate income is a little bit smaller percentage, and also it's notoriously volatile. So it's not uncommon to see these large fluctuations.
You mentioned that that things don't seem to be rebounding as quickly now as you've seen them rebound after past recessions. To what do you attribute that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with just the depths of the Great Recession. You know, it was a very different economic downturn than the previous ones we saw in 2001, 1991. It was common, you know, in the 1990s and right after 2001 that you would have these robust growth rates and revenues that immediately after the recession ended that would be 6%, 8%, 9% for general fund revenue growth across the states. We're just not seeing that this time. We're just seeing that states are in this, I would almost say, a new era of slow and moderate growth.
Todd Haggerty is a policy analyst with the National Conference of State Legislatures.
We've heard about making a phone call from jail, but what about a video chat? Similar to Skype, video visitation allows inmates to see their friends and family while they talk. Prisons are increasingly adopting the technology, but there are fears it'll eventually lead to the elimination of in-person visits. The BBC's Laura Trevelyan went to Portsmouth, Virginia to see how it works.
You ready?
Hi, Daddy!
Cameron and Gabrielle Mansfield are thrilled to see their father over a video link.
How are you doing today?
He's been gone for 6 long weeks.
You look very tired.
Eric's in jail, facing burglary charges. His children are too young to visit the jail, but they can talk to him from just outside his cell using Skype-like technology.
What are y'all doing in school right now, Cameron?
Working with decimals.
Cameron is full of news for her father.
Like I said, I'm doing writing.
The separation from him has taken its toll, she tells me.
When I go to school and he's there, it is really sad.
Sergeant Ford.
Yes, sir.
Open two, please.
For Eric, who's in Portsmouth Jail in the state of Virginia, the contact with his girls means a lot, especially around the holiday period.
It makes it very awesome to be able to see them and not just talk to them over the phone. So it's made a big difference. It puts a big smile on my face and makes the day go by a lot easier.
For Eric's wife, Sheena, who must find a job to support the girls while her husband's in jail, this contact is crucial.
It'll be a lot easier for them to be able to know that he's only right down the street and he's right here in person, you know, face to face. So I think it'll be a little bit easier for them.
Portsmouth Jail in Virginia is one of many places across America that's adopting what's called video visitation for inmates. For the companies involved, it's big business. Gary Humphreys is the president of HomeWave, which provides the technology in prisons across 17 states.
How much does it cost the prisoners and their families to make the call?
It's 50 cents a minute.
Sounds expensive. Some people would say that you're profiteering from the vulnerable who are desperate to speak to their relatives in prison. What would you say to that?
We set up our model based on nonprofit. Virginia had a nonprofit video visitation program that was geared around 50 cents a minute. And we geared our model exactly the same as theirs. So I wouldn't consider profiteering. I mean, we're able to do it for the same price, yet, you know, make a modest profit off of it.
The question is whether inmates speaking to their families via video link could ultimately replace prison visits altogether. That's already happened in the District of Columbia. As prisons face pressure to cut costs, advocates for the rights of inmates fear they risk losing that human contact which can help with their rehabilitation.
All right, close two.
Yes, sir.
That's not a concern for Sheriff Bill Watson, who runs the maximum security jail where Eric's imprisoned.
I would like to see it replace personal visitations. We could do it a lot easier and a lot quicker.
Why?
More cost effective. You don't have to move the inmates back and forth. You don't need the extra bodies, the extra deputies to move these inmates back and forth.
For now, Portsmouth Jail allows both actual family visits and video link-ups. For Sheena Mansfield, seeing Eric in person is still important.
I'll use this, but I will probably at least go up once a month, at least. To me, it doesn't feel right if I don't.
Love you, Daddy.
I love you too, Gabby.
For Cameron and Gabrielle, who have I love you, Daddy written on the palms of their hands, a virtual visit is so much better than nothing.
Bye, Daddy. Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
That's the BBC's Laura Trevelyan.
Still to come, an Arizona national park is adding some land, and for scientists, it's like Christmas morning.
It's a brand new exposure, and it's full of fossils. And in fact, our preliminary work that we did out there, we found some new stuff.
That story's ahead. It's the show.
Certainly looks like a great weekend around the valley. We'll have partly to mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 70. And then partly sunny on Sunday with a high of 71. Currently, relative humidity is at 17%. And under mostly sunny skies, it's 73 degrees at KJZZ. Quickly to the Valley freeways, a couple of accidents in the West Valley. One is on the 101 eastbound at 75th Avenue. The other on the 101 northbound at 91st Avenue.
KJZZ is supported by Actors Theater presenting 4,000 Miles January 10th through 26th. The Arizona premiere of a heartfelt drama that was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Drama. ActorsTheaterPHX.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. In the tech world, time shifting has been the deal for years.
There's live streamed, and just streamed.
There's downloadable, downloaded, and YouTubed.
And the just posted nearly live Snapchat.
Is this really 2014 or just a download of the future from the past?
This language distortion comes courtesy of the cloud,
which is the digital domain of so much of our reality right now.
Two words for you, Edward Snowden. Those downloads from the NSA from the past are shaping the future of privacy as we speak and help to define 2013.
In terms of technology, no one knows the cloud and its implications better than Manoush Zomorodi, host of the WNYC podcast New Tech City. Manoush, the cloud itself is not new, but in cultural terms, is 2014 the possible ultimate harmonic convergence of the cloud?
What I want to say is that the cloud will just be normal. We will stop talking about it because it's just going to be what we all come to expect all the time. We expect to be able to access our photo library. We expect to be able to access our documents, our email, everywhere we go. And maybe we'll stop shelling out for all that extra space, for all that extra capacity on our gadgets because we don't have to pay for it because we have everything in the cloud.
Don't buy stock in hard drive manufacturers. The cloud is going to basically be responsible for all the backups.
Well, you know, I say that, and then I'm remembering this guy that we interviewed this year who now backs his stuff up in five different places after Hurricane Sandy did a number on his business. He has two hard drives, two separate cloud places, and then I don't know where the one I think he carries around with his backpack like at all times. So you can't be too paranoid. But then the other thing, I mean, look, there's a couple other things. You need connectivity all the time for the cloud, and we're just not there yet. I mean, certain cities you could be. If you live in Chattanooga, I'm assuming that everyone is on the cloud at all times in Chattanooga or places like Kansas City where Google Fiber is.
Now, connectivity leads us directly to communication, and we're really starting to develop a kind of syntax of digital communication in our sharing of files and images. Explain.
I mean, I think what we're going to see this year is moving towards communicating with pictures more than anything. We now communicate in tiny little texts. We communicate on Twitter in 140 characters. But let's face it, the reason why the cliche, right? A picture's worth a thousand words. Clichés are always true for a reason. And I think with some things like Instagram, which did incredibly well this year, there was a new number that came out from the Pew research that says that half of us who have been on the internet, half of us have posted original photos or videos to a website. So that means we're all getting more used to sharing pictures. We're getting used to telling stories with video. And I think Snapchat was one of the most interesting things that happened at the end of the year. Yeah, they got offered to be bought by Facebook reportedly for $3 billion, and they said no.
And the innovation there is that it's a technology that allows pictures to sort of fade away, go away. It basically deals with the privacy question by sending images that have a perishability to them.
Let me give you an example. My nanny and I don't speak Spanish very well. Her English is... So how do we communicate? Pictures. How are the? You left your glasses. I send her a picture of her glasses on the bureau. How are the kids? The best way to know is to take a picture of them eating their snack after school, right? Do I need to save those photos? They're not like, you know, gorgeous pieces of creativity. They're information.
Communication leads directly to some of the rules and the questions of how we actually mediate this technology.
I think a year ago we were still talking about, should I do this or shouldn't I do this? The question, especially for parents, I think they're the people who maybe had to deal with it first because they didn't understand it, was how do you balance it? It's not an if or, it's how do we make it work with how we live? So a story that we did this year was about a summer camp that instead of taking away the gadgets for summer camp, they let them have them and be in a safe place to try to figure out how to live life in make friends in real life and also coexist with their gadgets and find some balance where they draw the line personally. I think that going forward, it's not saying no to technology. It's saying, where do I draw the line with technology?
Finally, will this be the year that health and health matters and health information really gets integrated into our technological lives and our technological platforms?
I mean, I'm sure over the last year, people saw more and more of their colleagues or friends wearing those bracelets on their wrists, right, that are tracking how many steps they're walking. That's mostly what we've seen. But I think what we're going to start to see are new kinds of wristbands that measure a lot more, that measure, are you very sweaty at certain times during the day? Is it because maybe you're not well? Or how many heartbeats per hour are you doing? Is that a sign of something?
And compiling that information.
Exactly. It's the next step is, what do we do with all the data that these wristbands are collecting? We talked to one office that gave these wristbands to all of their workers and then tracked them to see who slept the best in the office. Makes you a little uncomfortable because this should be private, right? But what we're going to
see, these
are the questions.
I do feel like if we get rid of some of the privacy questions, we can make more intelligent decisions about public health if the right people have the right information and it's not used against us. But that's something for another day.
I totally agree with you. But do you want your boss to be like, oh, John, I see you didn't sleep well last night. That really explains why you did such a crappy show, right? Like, nobody wants... Not that that would ever happen, John.
No,
but you know what I'm saying.
I get that memo every Tuesday. How did you find out about that?
Can I just tell you about one that's coming this year?
Sure.
It sounds so cool. It's called the Aero Wristband. It's supposed to launch in the fall. This is supposed to be able to use light waves to figure out how many calories you ate during the day and also how many of those calories were actually nutritious. I mean, Nirvana coming in 2014, right?
Can I exclude my boss from the list of people who gets that information?
Yes.
Just saying.
And can I take it out over Halloween? Take it off? I don't want to wear it over Halloween. I'll be embarrassed how much candy I eat.
Oh, that's so long from today, Halloween.
Right?
Yes, exactly. Well, have a great year.
You too.
Manush Zamarodi, host of the WNYC podcast, New Tech City, on Tech in the New Year.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Ask us where the world center of the casino industry is, and we'll probably think of Las Vegas or Atlantic City. But maybe we should think again. Right now, the most lucrative market for casino gambling is the island of Macau in southern China. The Economist predicts gamblers will wager about $50 billion there next year, far more than Las Vegas. And pretty soon, Vegas will be pushed farther down the gaming ladder by a newcomer. Japan is on the brink of legalizing gambling. The BBC's Russell Padmore explains.
Japan is planning to legalize casinos for the first time, giving gamblers a chance to bet red or black at the roulette table or feed coins into the type of slot machines familiar to gamers in Las Vegas. The Japanese parliament, the Diet, is expected to introduce legislation to legalize casinos within months. And it's a prospect that excites the global gaming industry, because Japan will become the world's second most lucrative market for casinos after the Chinese territory of Macau. Industry experts estimate the move by the Japanese government to allow casinos will create an industry worth $15 billion a year. Warwick Bartlett, the chief executive of global betting and gaming consultancy, says gambling is part of Japanese culture.
1 million people leave Japan every year to gamble. They go to the South Korea casinos, they go as far as Australia and Macau. And I think the government is taking the view that if our citizens are going abroad to gamble, why shouldn't they gamble in their own country? Everybody would want a piece of the action in Japan, because we mustn't forget that it's a population of 127 million people with a gross domestic product per capita of $37,000.
The Japanese government is convinced legalizing casinos will be a winner for the economy, and it's thought the country will initially allow two casino resorts to be built in partnership with foreign investors. That's where Vegas comes in, as casino operators like MGM or Las Vegas Sands are already major players in Asia. And with Japan about to open up the world's second biggest gaming market, it's a betting opportunity the American companies will find hard to ignore. Japanese politicians hope the first gaming resort will be built before the Tokyo Olympics in 2020. That's an opportunity to attract more visitors to the roulette tables or slot machines.
The BBC's Russell Padmore pressing his bet in Japan.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I am Cody Kavanaugh, and I am at the dog park with my buddy Troy. It's good for him. Gets his energy out. He enjoys it. And it gets me outside. He can socialize with other people, and he gets to socialize with other animals as well. I don't really ever have a bad experience here.
That's Cody Kavanaugh hanging out with his dog Troy at Mitchell Park in Tempe. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, or just frankly want to send us pictures of your dog, that's cool. Send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
What is the show? It's a KJZZ original production that mixes news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national, even international news, to provide a stream of engaging radio. It's 2:34, time for the latest headlines from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jamie McIntyre. Lawyers for same-sex couples in Utah have filed papers with the Supreme Court arguing that gay marriages should be allowed to continue, and that the state's request for an emergency stay should be denied. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The brief filed with Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor argues that Utah has failed to demonstrate irreparable harm to the state if same-sex marriages continue. Utah voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment a decade ago limiting marriage to heterosexual couples. 2 weeks ago, a U.S. District Court judge declared the amendment unconstitutional, and he and a federal appeals court refused to stop hundreds of gay marriages. Sotomayor can consider an emergency stay herself or refer the decision to the entire court. The same-sex couples argue that halting marriages during the appeals process imposes an intolerable and dehumanizing burden. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Republican Senator John McCain met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem today, where Secretary of State John Kerry was making his 10th visit to try to broker peace with the Palestinians. McCain says he shares some of Netanyahu's concerns about the U.S.-backed plan.
When we hear very serious and legitimate concerns on the part of the Prime Minister, we take those into consideration.
McCain was in Israel with fellow Republican Senators John Barrasso of Wyoming and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina following a visit to Afghanistan. Graham says he's very worried about the overall stability in the Mideast.
I just fear that 2014 could be a year of utter disaster in the region.
Secretary Kerry met for a second time in 2 days with Netanyahu before traveling to Ramallah to meet with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. On Wall Street today, the Dow closed up 28 to 16,469, but the S&P fell a fraction and NASDAQ lost 11 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein with some headlines from around the region. Crews have moved the tanker that had been leaking ethanol to an area that'll be easier for them to work on. They've been getting rid of any ethanol left inside. Officials have estimated the 30,000-gallon tanker was still up to half full. Fire units from Phoenix, Chandler, and Tempe, as well as officials from the County Air Quality Department, Corporation Commission, and Phoenix Police are also working at the scene.
State Senator Linda Lopez will resign her seat in the legislature effective on January 13th. That's the first day of the 2014 session. Lopez has said for a few weeks that she planned to step down to focus on a new job. The Arizona Capital Times reports her resignation letter laments some soon-to-be former colleagues, quote, diminution of respect for the institution and for other members of the legislature.
Mesa's mayor and city council members will be getting a raise, but they'll only be effective for members elected later this year. The mayor's pay will increase from $33,600 to more than $73,000. Council members' salaries will go from more than $16,000 to more than $36,000 a year.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein, along with our partner at PRI's The World, host Marco Werman.
London's Guardian newspaper said at the end of 2013 that it had only published 1% of Edward Snowden's leaked classified NSA documents, so you know there's a lot more to come.
Just today, The Washington Post published an article based on yet another one of Snowden's revelations. And just a couple of days ago, The New York Times published an editorial calling for clemency for Snowden. I spoke about that today with Glenn Greenwald. He was one of two Guardian journalists who first received Snowden's trove of leaked NSA docs 7 months ago. Greenwald is now an investigative journalist for First Look Media and lives in Rio de Janeiro. I asked him if the Times editorial surprised him.
It did surprise me. The New York Times has been somewhat supportive of Edward Snowden, but not very enthusiastically, which is somewhat surprising given that they've published numerous articles now based on the documents that he provided to The Guardian, which in turn provided them to The Times. But this not only was an enthusiastic endorsement of what Edward Snowden did, but a very well-constructed and thoughtful argument about why it is that he shouldn't face criminal charges.
And what does it mean to you that this editorial came from the New York Times, the newspaper of historic record, so it says, and is it a vindication for you?
It's definitely significant. I mean, the New York Times, for whatever flaws it has, and there are many, still is far and away the most influential newspaper, the most important newspaper in the United States when it comes to shaping public discourse and particularly the views of political and media elites. They also tend to define mainstream thought. So if the New York Times editorially takes a position, it's very difficult to dismiss that position as fringe or radical or extremist or anything like that. So it really brought the idea not only that Snowden deserved clemency, but that he's really a heroic whistleblower who has done a great service for his country, as the Times said, into mainstream thought in a way that's very hard to demonize. And sure, I think it is a vindication, especially for Mr. Snowden, but for the work that we've been doing in our work as journalists with him, when an institution like the New York Times recognizes how beneficial it has been for everyone to learn of these things.
What has your life been like since you sat down last year to speak with Edward Snowden in Hong Kong?
It's been, I guess the best word for it would be intense. And, you know, it's been intense on a lot of different levels. Obviously, when you're in the middle of a sort of major media storm, when you suddenly have in your possession tens of thousands of top secret documents from the most secretive agency of the world's most powerful government, then obviously there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of significant and difficult choices that you have to make. You get attacked in lots of different ways. You're the extent to which your journalism is scrutinized and even your personal life intensifies. So all of those things have definitely happened and have created a lot of pressure. At the same time, when you go into journalism, the thing that you hope to be able to do is to work on a story like this one. And so it's been very invigorating and fulfilling for me, especially given how much work I've done over the years on surveillance.
And for you, Glenn Greenwald, where did those political values come from? If you have to dig way, way back, was there a formative moment?
You know, I mean, I think that we all probably have experiences throughout adolescence when we're sort of discovering who we are that shapes not just our personal values, but our political values. And I've talked before about growing up gay in the 1980s when, you know, there was a great deal of kind of hostility towards gay people, especially in the suburbs. And it sort of creates this, you know, this reaction in you, and there's different people who react in different ways. And I think one of the ways that I reacted was to question the entitlement of institutions and people purporting to have authority to issue these kind of decrees, and rather than just blindly accepting these decrees, sought to examine them and their entitlement to make them. And I think it has just led me to be a more kind of critical person and more skeptical of the pronouncements of institutions that aren't accompanied by very clear evidence.
How would you describe your own legal situation at the moment? I mean, what would happen if you came to the U.S. right now?
It's unclear, and I don't think anyone really knows the answer to that. We have had lots of lawyers who have looked at the situation, all of whom say that there's some non-trivial risk that, given the history of the Obama administration when it comes to secrecy and journalism and press freedoms and whistleblowers, that if I tried to return to the United States, I could be charged or prosecuted or at the very least served with a subpoena. Obviously, my partner, when he was working in conjunction with myself and my fellow journalist, Laura Poitras.
Right, that's David Rivera, who was detained at Heathrow Airport.
At Heathrow Airport, right. He was detained for close to 11 hours under a terrorism law that is designed to investigate terrorism. And then when the UK had to defend what it did, they said, well, we think the potential publication of these documents is a form of terrorism, essentially equating journalism and terrorism. So you see the US and the UK governments both reacting in a rather extreme ways to what is clearly the largest national security leak in American history. And so there's no sure bet when it comes to trying to figure out what they'll do next.
So living there in Rio in Brazil, do you feel like you're in kind of exile?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely intend fully to come back to the United States. I refuse to let myself be exiled for the crime of committing journalism. I want to make sure that I have a better idea of what the options and the risks and the probabilities are before I do that. You know, I've lived in Brazil for 8 years, so it's not unusual for me to be here. It's unusual for me to feel like I can't safely return to my own country. But that's just the nature of doing this sort of journalism. If you do journalism that angers and is adversarial to people with a great deal of power, they're going to do things back to you. That's the nature of having power. And so none of this really surprises me. I had a good idea that a lot of this would be happening when I decided to do what I did and definitely consider the price worth paying.
How often do you speak with Edward Snowden?
I speak to him regularly, quite regularly.
And do you talk about, like, these issues? Like, what's at stake if we both go back to the United States? I mean, I think it's pretty clear right now for Snowden.
Sure. And, you know, it's interesting. When we were in Hong Kong, the three of us, myself, Laura Poitras, and Edward Snowden, we talked about what we all thought were going to be the likely consequences for each of us in terms of what it is that we were doing. And we assumed that he was going to end up in U.S. custody sooner rather than later and probably facing charges that could put him into a prison cell for the next several decades. But Laura and I also talked about how as journalists we were likely to be targeted in all sorts of ways as well. And sure, as it's all played out, we continue to talk about those things. But actually, I think the prevailing sentiment among the three of us is that things have gone wildly better than we ever anticipated that it would, not just in terms of the intense debate and interest level that has been provoked around the world, sustained now for more than 6 months, but having a federal court rule that the program we exposed is against the law and unconstitutional, having huge swaths of the American public change how they view issues of privacy and civil liberties versus the threat of terrorism, all sorts of elite institutions coming to the realization that the NSA is a rogue and out of control and dangerous institution. I mean, that's generally more what we spend our time talking about. The risks are something that we just knew were always there.
Journalist Glenn Greenwald speaking with us from Rio de Janeiro. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's The World's Marco Werman joining us from Boston.
New technology pushes out the old. We know that. The car pushed out the horse and buggy. Electricity pushed out candle power. It's called progress, except that sometimes old technologies just won't go away, like vinyl.
Once upon a time, records used to be on vinyl, but then came along the MP3 and streaming. But don't tell the Germans that. Near Berlin, there's a company making vinyl records, and the demand is going through the roof. The BBC's Steve Evans drops the needle on this story.
Some of us remember the scratching, the clicks, and the pops of a dead technology. Except vinyl is back. Around the world, sales of vinyl records are at their highest since 1997. The Dodo Beach record shop in Berlin is new, and it only sells vinyl. Thomas Spindler owned a record shop 20 years ago, around the corner, and he's just opened this new one. It's selling more than the old one did.
Massive. Vinyl is growing massive. We are very specialized. We only sell vinyl. We sell special kind of music. We bring all the American, Australian, Canadian imports. More people coming and showing interest about vinyl and records.
Why?
If you buy a record, you buy free time for yourself because you slow down. You take the record and it needs time, you know. You see the cover, you read the lyrics, you can do all that slowing down a little bit. If you do that on a computer, it's massive information and, you know, it's not really free time, you know. And I think that's a big difference, you know, like holding something in the hand, you know, take your time, put it on the record player, relax and listen to the music. It's real listening, it's real time.
Is the sound any different?
Yeah, it's a little bit warmer.
The argument is that CDs and MP3s don't convey the full real sound. Digital recordings don't capture the loudest sounds. They compress it all into a middling range. So say the customers.
With MP3 music, you lose a lot of the music because of the compression.
And there's something about picking up an album cover and just holding the thing.
Yeah, you touch something with vinyl.
In a factory in northern Germany, the Optimal Media Company is pressing vinyl records. The snag is that the machines to do it on are ancient. Peter Runger, the company's operations director, says he and his colleagues look all over the world for old machines to press today's vinyl records.
Most of the people thought in the early 90s that vinyl would be dead, and they scrapped all their machines. And then we had to expand because of the growing demand. And then we had to go to different countries like Russia, Sweden, England to get more old machines because the last ones were made in the early 80s.
And what kind of places do you find these things?
We found them in old barns or sheds or a warehouse or in factories they were about to knock down.
Part of the appeal of vinyl seems to be the ritual involved in playing music. You hold the album cover, you read the album cover, you gently take the record from the album cover, and then finally you place the treasured record with reverence on the altar, which is the turntable. It isn't very modern, but it might satisfy the soul.
That's the BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin.
Taking a look at Valley traffic this Friday afternoon, a few problem spots. 101 northbound in the West Valley, an accident blocking the exit ramp at 91st Avenue. Also an accident on the exit ramp 101 eastbound at 75th Avenue. And there's an accident blocking the shoulder, I-17 northbound at Cactus.
Winter weather that most of us can get very used to. Partly cloudy skies for tomorrow with a high temperature of 70. And then warming to 71 under mostly sunny skies for Sunday. Our normal for this weekend is around 65 degrees. Currently, relative humidity at 17%. Under mostly sunny skies, it's 73 degrees at 2:50.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Principal guest conductor Joanne Folletta conducts Beethoven's most famous work, January 9th and 10th. More information at phoenixsymphony.org.
One of Arizona's national parks is getting bigger. Petrified Forest National Park is adding more than 4,200 acres after a couple of outside groups bought the land and transferred it to the National Park Service. This comes almost a decade after Congress authorized the park's expansion. Bill Parker is the Petrified Forest National Park's paleontologist.
The land that we just purchased, it's off of our eastern boundary of what was the park up till 2004. We were authorized in 2004 to expand the park to the east and the west, and we've been slowly accumulating properties along our east side.
And what's significant about this land? I mean, have you found artifacts or fossils on this land?
The area contains exposures of a geologic unit called the Chinle Formation, which is from the late Triassic period, and it's very similar to the rest of the rocks we have in the park, but historically this has been an area where institutions in the past, such as the American Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian, have had luck doing fossil exploration out there.
When will this be open to the public?
That's being discussed right now. One of the first things we have to do is go out there. We have to do what's called an inventory. So we have to go out there and actually record what we've just bought, and this would include any fossils that we find. Any that are of scientific significance, we actually collect to preserve them, and they end up in our museum collection here. And then once this inventory is done, then we can start looking at opening these areas up to the public.
Now, I would imagine as a paleontologist, the idea of going out into this land that you've not really seen much before is pretty exciting.
It is pretty exciting. It's almost like Christmas or birthday, you know, you don't know what you're going to get out there. So it's a brand new exposure, and it's full of fossils. And in fact, our preliminary work that we did out there, we found some new stuff.
So ultimately, now that you've added this other piece of land, what will change or what will be different for visitors to the park?
Well, two things that we get from this. One is more information. The park was established to preserve paleontology from the Triassic period, which is when dinosaurs and things like that first show up in the fossil record. And we had a lot of information in the park, but some of these outside areas have even more information. The other thing it allows us to do is the existing park was kind of restricted on what we could do for visitor services. So, for example, we don't have any campgrounds. We have short hiking trails. Currently, we don't allow any off-road vehicles or bicycles in areas. And these new lands were not really constrained by that, so we can kind of get creative and maybe offer some new hiking and biking and possibly even in some point some camping opportunities that visitors don't currently have here now.
Bill Parker is the Petrified Forest National Park's paleontologist. Bill, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Steve, you grew up in Phoenix. What comes to mind when you think about Arizona?
Mark, hot weather, I guess a cactus, maybe the citrus in my backyard. But as we know, there's a lot more to Arizona than that.
Indeed. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us about some of the things that make us different.
Every state has something that represents it. A state flower, a bird, a tree, and animals. They're recognized as symbols that show how unique it is. Did you know Arizona has 17 symbols to represent the state?
When you're looking at an official state symbol,
You're looking at the end product of the lawmaking process.
Alice Duckworth is with the Arizona Capitol Museum, where the state symbols are showcased.
And so every once in a while, they'll introduce a bill regarding a symbol as a way for children to follow the process.
State symbols are often officially recognized after the legislature votes them into law. Most of Arizona's symbols became official in the 20th century. Only a few were recognized in the last few years. The first official symbol for Arizona is the seal, introduced in 1911. It includes the Latin motto, Ditat Deus, meaning God enriches. 6 years later, the state flag was recognized.
The original 13 colonies are represented in the rays of the setting sun.
By the fourth grade, Arizona students are introduced to the state's history. Symbols are part of the lesson. So I dare to ask, are you smarter than a fourth grader? Let's see. What's the state flower? Yes, the saguaro cactus blossom. What's the state bird? Yep, the cactus wren. How about the state tree? It's the Palo Verde. Here's another. What is Arizona's state reptile? Gotcha, didn't I? It got me. It's the ridged-nosed rattlesnake.
As I tell the kids, you know that little thing of milk you get for lunch? If you open that container up, you could put the rattlesnake in it. Not that we would want to.
Arizona is also represented by a gemstone, turquoise. Our state fish is the Apache trout. The fossil is the petrified wood. The amphibian is the Arizona tree frog. Our mammal is the ringtail, related to the raccoon. The state butterfly is the two-tailed swallowtail. Arizona's colors are blue and gold. We even have an official neckwear. It's the bola tie. In 2011, the Arizona State Legislature introduced its newest symbol, the state firearm. It's the Colt Single Action Army Revolver. One interesting fact, for decades, Arizona's nickname has been, yes, the Grand Canyon State. Museum historians say if it weren't for an elementary school student doing research, the state legislature would never have made it official. We were the only state without a formal nickname until 2011. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
And did you know we're always looking for new ideas? If you've got one, send them to the show at kjzz.org.
Our lives have become more digital between email, social media accounts, sharing photos, and any number of other things. But what happens to all of that when we die? Evan Carroll thinks that's a question we all need to deal with. He's the co-founder of the website The Digital Beyond and the co-author of Your Digital Afterlife.
It's very easy to look at this issue and say, I don't have anything important online or in the digital form, and this I don't need to worry about this. But it's important to realize that we're all living a digital lifestyle. We have photographs, we have videos, we have things we've written, all sorts of things that we've stored in digital form, either on our computers, in our emails, or you know, on various social networking sites. And in reality, you can take 5 or 10 minutes to write down your most important accounts with their usernames and passwords, and you will have done more than 90% of the population. You will save your family so much time. So if you imagine how perhaps 15 years ago we didn't have things like Instagram and Facebook that allowed us to capture moments and share them so quickly. But now we have tons upon tons of information that we share online on a regular and almost incessant basis. And what we've come to realize is that unlike our tangible possessions, the things that are in our home that we can feel and touch, our digital possessions are much more fragile in that they can be easily deleted or copied or lost whenever we pass away.
Can one leave one's digital assets to someone in a will, in an estate plan, anything like that? I mean, is the law in accordance with where technology is at this point?
So right now, you're absolutely right that technology has kind of outpaced the law. But there are things you can do today that will help protect your digital assets for when you're gone. So one thing you can absolutely do is to incorporate them into your will. There are also numerous services that are available to you that can serve as sort of a password locker and hold onto your passwords in the event that you're gone. Now, your question related to the law, and it has law as the law caught up. And the answer is it is catching up. So right now we have six states who have enacted legislation that affect what happens to digital assets after their owner passes away, and we're expecting more.
So in addition to some of the legal issues, there's also, I guess, some ethical type issues. I mean, you have issues of maybe family members having access to information from a loved one who's passed away that they didn't know about and learning some stuff that maybe they weren't meant to learn. You also have the issue of, especially on social media, of folks posting to somebody's Facebook wall, for example, after they've passed away. From a social perspective, how do you think people should try to handle some of that?
So there certainly are ethical issues here, and I think this goes back to the age-old debate. Just because we can do something, should we do that? And I think in many of these situations, the answer is it depends. So let's take the example of someone posting to a social media account after you're gone. That can be a really important and useful thing if you have many online friends or followers who do not know you in real life and would have no way of knowing that you've passed away, and your family may want to post a brief note to that group and let them know that you've passed. On the other hand, it seems a bit weird and against social norms for someone who is gone to continue communicating. And so we would probably not want to see a family have access to an account and effectively take it over and begin living through that account.
Evan Carroll is the co-founder of The Digital Beyond. Evan, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The show was produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias. Our news director is Peter O'Dowd.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think at the show at kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein for Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. We hope you have a great weekend. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.